So, 2016. Love it or hate it, there's no arguing that it was quite a memorable year in the news, and forced us to think about who we are, what we want, and how we prioritize our lives. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week, we're taking a peek into the new year. We're also revisiting a few of our favorite moments and reporting from the past year, including stories about the 42 million Americans who owe student debt, and money lessons we've learned from some of our most memorable guests. Also, some of your New Year's money resolutions. Come share your thoughts with us at Marketplace.org, on Facebook or Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We are starting this special show with a twist on our segment Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance, long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. And this week, we're doing a special New Year's version, what our guests are long and short for 2017. We've brought in Joe Weisenthal, co-host of What'd You Miss on Bloomberg TV, and Marketplace's own Kimberly Adams. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hey there.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year
to you too.
Well, let's think about this. We're going to go long and short into 2017, what we are thinking about in the world of economics, politics, sociology, all of this stuff, how it all runs together in the new year. Kimberly, why don't you tee us up? What are you long?
I feel badly kind of starting it out on a downer, but I'm going to go long on income inequality. And that income inequality is only going to get worse in 2017. I mean, it's already been doing pretty badly. There was a study out from Berkeley just recently that said between the 1980s and 2014, the average pre-tax income of the top 1% of adults rose from $420,000 to $1.3 million, versus obviously not the same for the people in the lower incomes. I mean, their income share increased like 12%. So if we see the kind of tax plan that Donald Trump is putting forward, even though most people will get some kind of a tax cut, the largest benefit of the Trump tax plan as it currently stands goes to the people at higher income levels. And then there's another thing that's kind of been percolating around in my head about people who make money off of the stock market. The people who tend to gain a lot of wealth often make a lot of money off the stock market. And you can make money off the stock market by paying attention to data that comes out from governments, from companies, and following the markets, even following our numbers, right?
Sure.
But as we heard in our Marketplace poll, there are lots and lots of people in America who just don't believe economic indicators.
Yeah.
And so
including in many ways the president-elect.
Right, including the new administration.
Very true. But I think the people who are already making money in the markets and who do believe these indicators are going to continue to do so. Mm. And some of the people who were already economically disadvantaged in this economy, if they continue to not believe the numbers about the economy, I wonder if they're going to be able to benefit and navigate the terrain going forward.
I love that angle. I had never thought about it before, but the idea that misinformation, the sort of cynical push towards skepticism about all data having a sort of inequality effect of harming the people who aren't armed with the power to sort of get past that. I'd never thought about that before, but now that you say it, the financial and economic ramifications of that do seem pretty profound. And so, you know, you have all the people going into gold because they're told lies about the state of the economy and the ramifications that have. It's a really interesting twist on that.
Well, and one thing I wonder when we think about what the Federal Reserve is going to do over the course of 2017, we heard Janet Yellen talk a little bit about the normalization of their asset purchases, right? So unwinding lots of stuff that they bought during the recession, which they're still in the process of doing. And the argument that is twinned with that is that people at the top did the best, under the Fed's asset purchase program. I know that there are Fed people who would push back against that, but I do think the idea of like, okay, so if we return to some kind of normal policy, we might not, depends on what the economy's doing. Does that have any effect on inequality? I don't know.
I think the interest rate hikes, and we're expecting several interest rate hikes in 2017, based on what the people at the Fed are saying, is something that is also going to exacerbate income inequality, because we talk about interest rates and sort of how they affect, quote unquote, regular people in terms of like how much you're going to pay for a mortgage.
Yep.
But another thing it really impacts is how much you're paying on your credit card interest. Mm. I just got a notification from my credit card a couple of days ago saying, hey, your interest rates going up, because what is it based on? It's based on the Fed rate and whatever exorbitant rate they want to put on top of it. And so people who are already struggling, who already have a lot of credit card debt, are going to see themselves paying more in the coming year. But people who maybe are sitting on a lot of cash are going to see more money coming their way because they're going to be getting better interest rates.
So, Joe, I actually want to go to your short because I think it works in the same sort of high finance realm as Kimberly's a little bit. Walk me through it.
Yeah, I guess I'm taking a slightly opposite spin on what could happen this year. Not totally different, but I don't think this year is going to be as great for the big banks as people expect. And so we've seen this huge surge in shares of companies like Goldman Sachs since the election, and there's a lot of reasons why people seem to be excited. One of them is expectations of regulatory rollback. Another one is expectations of higher growth due to perhaps more fiscal spending, more deficit spending under this president. And all those arguments kind of make sense. But it just feels to me like, A, nothing ever works out quite like people expect. You know, going back to 2009, a lot of people were worried that Obama was going to be some big socialist and very bad for Wall Street, and he bashed bonuses, but it turned out to be amazing years for Wall Street. Then beyond that, one of the things that I think is underappreciated is the connection between finance, particularly complicated finance, and globalization. And so you trade overseas, that requires currency hedging, letters of credit for actual trade. And a lot of the growth of the financial industry, particularly Wall Street in particular, is very much mirrors the explosion of globalization. As we have more administrations who are less inclined for globalization in one way or another, maybe not dramatic ripping up the trade deals, but hurting globalization at the margins, that will reduce the need for a lot of the services that these big banks offer. And so my belief is that 2017 and beyond won't be as great for Wall Street as people think.
Boy,
but here's the thing about that.
Mm-hmm.
We're basing all of this on this premise that the policies we've been hearing coming out of the Trump campaign and the transition team are the policies that are actually going to be pursued.
True.
And I'm not entirely convinced that that's going to be the case. We've seen a lot of, movement in policy stances since Trump got elected, and I imagine we'll see more. And there's also the fact that that transition team is really scrambling to get all the people they need in place in time for him to take office. And so I think there's going to be maybe a longer than usual ramp up time from when Donald Trump enters office and when he actually is able to start implementing some of these policy goals that he has. And so I guess I agree with you, but I'm also taking a step back and saying that's if what we've heard is going to happen actually happens.
Okay, so this might be the last time I get to do it. I'm going to quote Hamilton. Winning is easy, young man. Governing is harder.
Perfect use of that line here.
Thank you. I was really excited about it. Also, Joe, you teed up Kimberly's short perfectly. Hit it, Adams.
I am going short on multilateral trade deals in particular, because nobody really likes them anymore. Nobody in at least governments, and especially as we move to more populist governments all over the world that are just saying, nope, arms crossed. We want more protectionist policies. We're going to focus on jobs for our workers. And suddenly, after decades of hearing something different, trade is suddenly bad. And I think that the United States in particular is going to be really, really reexamining its trade deals. And I think that's going to happen regardless of what Trump does. I think our Republican Congress is going to be pushing for that, as well as Trump supporters are going to be demanding
it. And many of the sort of more left-leaning Democrats.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of the people in unions who broke ranks with many times their own union to support Trump in the election because of trade. And that, I think, creates an opportunity for China. And I think we're going to see them be more active on the global stage. The Chinese are quite active already in terms of global trade, but I think we're going to see them take more of a leadership role moving forward as the U.S. retreats in this arena.
It really is remarkable the degree to which nobody at this point in the U.S. political sphere really wants to stand up for these trade deals anymore. On the right or the left, at best you hear people say, well, the trade deals have merit to them, but they need a lot of work. Very few people, unlike the 90s and early 2000s, enthusiastically making the case for free trade.
All right, Joe. So if trade is meh, big banks, meh, income inequality persists, what are you long?
I am long digital currencies in 2017. I think for a long time they've been the realm of either very out there tech types or anti-government libertarians, and most mainstream people were sort of skeptical that they had any value. But they continue to grow quietly. They didn't get a lot of hype in 2016.
No.
And I think as people around the world are across the ideological aisle, left and right, more skeptical about government, more into privacy and things like that, that there will be a continued and growing interest in various non-traditional ways of moving money around.
But who's going to accept them?
Well, people.
Oh, I know.
Yes.
Oh. I was actually out with friends the other day, and after going to this concert, we stopped at a falafel shop, and there was a sign inside, and it said, "We accept Bitcoin."
There you go.
And we were having this discussion about it because it was in a very trendy neighborhood in D.C. And there were like, it was open late, so all the partygoers were going in there. And then this big sign, it said, you know, we accept Bitcoin. And we were talking about it and somebody said, well, it doesn't mean anything. It's not backed by anything. And they said, well, what is the U.S. dollar backed
right.
by?
True.
That's the argument I love. And people work themselves in knots with these philosophical questions about where does it come from? What's it backed by? But then if you start expanding that, like all of reality starts to fall apart if we push too hard.
Right. Well, and if you know, really answer that question, it's backed by faith in the U.S. Right. government. And that's a little low right now
exactly.
in most people's
So
mind.
That's exactly right. If people are losing faith in their government, then people might be willing to seek out monetary alternatives.
All right. We're ending it there because you guys are amazing. Joe Wiesenthal, Kimberly Adams, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
In this episode, we're listening to some of our favorite stories. And during the presidential campaign, producer Eliza Mills and I worked with our partners at Frontline and the PBS NewsHour to look at student debt. 42 million Americans owe educational debt, some $1.3 trillion of it. This first story is about a generation of students who graduated into the worst of the recession. Now that the economy is recovering, are they? If everything had gone according to his plan, Chris Savelle would be a Wall Street trader right now, not biking through downtown Detroit. Sure, he likes being out here, part of a weekly community ride called Slow Roll. Not far from the suburb where he lives. But Chris graduated from Central Michigan University right into the recession.
December 2008.
After 6 months of looking for a finance job, he became a manager at Walmart.
We used to make jokes in that store because it was one of the most well-qualified Walmart stores I think we've ever seen. The number of laid-off engineers was amazing.
Chris lives with his mom and sister now. After 9 months at Walmart, he got lucky and landed a job in supply chain management. It's not Wall Street, but he likes it and makes $85,000 a year. That covers rent, a little bit of savings, and the $1,000 a month he pays toward his $100,000 in student loans.
It sucks. To put it simple, it sucks.
Chris is an outlier. The average student loan burden is around $37,000. He's also a study in what happened to a generation that figured the economy would be fine, the housing market wouldn't crash, and somehow they'd make it work. Then, of course, everything cratered.
I did this to myself.
I knew when I was taking out these loans that I was building up a bigger and bigger debt burden, but told myself, oh, you know, I'll have a good job when I get out of college, so on and so forth.
For Chris and other students his age, the price of college shot up. Since 2000, the cost of going to a public university is up 54%. In Chris Savelle's case, one credit hour at Central Michigan cost $148 when he started school. When he finished, more than 5 years later, the same credit cost $324.
The major thing driving that increase is that states used to fund public higher education.
That's Sarah Goldrick-Robb. She's a professor at Temple University and studies the price of higher ed.
They withdrew some of their support. And in doing so, somebody has to pick up that tab. And they basically decided that the people going to college and their families should pay for that.
Meanwhile, middle-class incomes barely budged, which means a family today spends a much larger share of its wealth on paying for college than one a generation ago.
The big change over time is that loans, taking loans, used to be much more of a choice. You could do it or not do it and figure out a way to make ends meet.
And many students have.
They don't like repaying their debts, but they're fine.
That's Sandy Baum from the Urban Institute.
Their earnings premium from going to college is far higher than is necessary to pay back those loans.
Even Chris Savelle is glad he has a degree. But for him and many people who graduated into the teeth of the recession, student debt essentially put the start of their adult lives on hold.
They're not renting apartments. They're not purchasing cars. They're not starting businesses. I mean, they're not really starting their lives.
Lisa Madigan is the Illinois Attorney General. Her office is pushing servicers, the people who collect payments on behalf of the government or commercial lenders, to put borrowers into repayment plans based on their incomes so that the rest of their lives become more manageable.
The people who are most impacted are low-income, African-American, Latino families who finally put a child, put their family through college, and now seemingly are stuck with this lifetime of debt that even if the parents and grandparents try to help, they can't seem to ever make the payments.
Worries about making loan payments have changed the way the next generation thinks about college. Chris Savelle's little sister Katie is terrified of debt. She's 19, did one semester in college, didn't really like it, and immediately repaid her debt with money from her job at a bakery. She's not in school now, over her mother's objections. Her brother's experience just scared her too much.
I do not want to end up in the same sort of financial issues that I've seen all these people so close to me have to go through.
Instead, she's now looking at cheaper one-year programs that would give her the skills to work in the film industry.
I would like to go to a technical school that would give me a certificate, somewhere like the Motion Picture Institute. I was looking into a program like that. It's very hands-on, and it's a full-year course, and they want like $13,000.
And maybe that is the lasting legacy of Chris Savelle's generation of debtors. More and more students around the country asking whether a traditional college education has become too much of a risk. We just heard from Chris and Katie Savelle about how student loan debt is affecting their lives. But there's another member of the Savelle household who's been rocked by Chris's debt, his mother, Jan. Here's what she wanted for her kids and her family.
In my family, we really believe in education. We never had any other expectation except that they would go to college.
That expectation has been shattered.
It's really frustrating. I feel bad for Chris that he's supporting me and supporting Katie and having to carry that debt load because I can't get a full-time job. And to me, watching Katie, to me, she's throwing her life away. She is such a bright girl. I mean, this is a girl who, when they do testing, she is gifted. She is so incredibly brilliant. And to see her not pursuing education because she doesn't want to take on that debt, I've tried to tell her that a small liberal arts school would probably be better for her. It would fit her personality better. But they also tend to be much more expensive. She tried the big state school, and she just could not fit in. She just saw the whole thing as a big waste, and she could see the student loan debt going to rack up over the years to come, because even though she got a lot of financial aid for her freshman year, typically with most schools that gets cut back. We saw what her financial aid package would be for her sophomore year, and it was already substantially reduced. So you know that the loans you're taking out just get bigger and bigger. I don't know what Katie's plans are. She's not even quite 19 yet. But I just see the more they get saddled with that kind of debt, how it impacts their future. She had about $5,000, $6,000 in student debt for her freshman year, and she didn't even want that hanging over her head. She works part-time, and she put almost every penny into paying off that loan, and she has got that one paid off. And she said, I don't want to be in debt like that. It scares me half to death. You can't go out and buy a car. You can't get a house. You can't do a lot of the things you want to do because that student loan debt is hanging over you. You are stuck with that forever. It goes to the grave with you.
If Chris Savelle is slogging through $100,000 in debt and slowly recovering, well, that same amount can be pretty different in another family. We drove an hour outside of Chicago to the town of Crystal Lake, where Jordan Heft lives with his parents. Unlike Chris, who's supporting his mother and sister, Jordan is 31 and lives at home to save money on rent. He also has $100,000 in debt. He went to Columbia College to study film, couldn't get a job in the film industry, and now works in a grocery store. The Hefts welcomed us into their home for dinner of roasted veggies and grilled chicken.
I got raspberry iced tea, mango lemonade, ginger ale, water pop.
We sat down to eat, and the Hefts got to talking about Jordan's loans.
We don't expect any of our children to not pay their debt. They have to be responsible for what they chose to do. Mm-hmm. But it's the interest is so high. And he's only able to make interest-only payments because the interest is so high.
Yeah.
And so I said, you're never going to pay it off.
It was just lower interest and just lower payments. It wouldn't be that big of a deal. But.
And he's stuck, too, because he can't really leave the job that has insurance now to go pursue what he went to college for.
What he pays, he can't afford a rent, a car payment.
I've had some of my friends in college or from college say, we shouldn't have to pay any of that back. I'm like, no, that was money that was given to you. You have to pay it back, but it should be at a reasonable time and a reasonable rate.
Melody and I did not go to college. So I call it college illiterate. Mm-hmm. We didn't know. And I think the schools, I think the colleges a little bit have to be held accountable too. I mean, somewhere along the line they have to say, listen, you're going to come here. This is what it's going to be. When you walk out, you better be ready to get a job because in 6 months, guess what?
Well, they made it look like there was... You're going to get a job right out of college. It'll be great. Well,
did you feel like the college was advising you? Whose interest did you think they were acting
totally,
in?
Totally, I think
there's the college.
Yeah.
At the time, did you feel that way?
No. At the time, we thought, oh my goodness. He's going to end up in Hollywood.
And I don't know if the economy was part to blame, too, because it's when the economy went bad. And really, we should have just cut our losses and said, do something else.
Right. I mean, he has no regrets. So that part's...
And I've always said if I could go back, I would still go to college. I would not do it as an experience I enjoyed. And it's just, I would have done it more smartly.
Well, you have said you would have gone to junior college. When you get a certification for something and
if you didn't do it, you could be sitting in that same chair going, I wish I would have just gone to college.
When you look at student debt around the country, the good news is that defaults are falling as the economy improves. But there is one group that defaults more than any other, students who go or went to for-profit colleges. Those students account for 35% of defaults in the last 3 years. So why is this happening? I went to talk to some borrowers to find out. When you look at student debt around the country, the good news is that defaults are falling as the economy improves. But there is one group that defaults more than any other: students who go or went to for-profit colleges. New data from the Department of Education shows those students account for 35% of defaults in the last 3 years. So why is this happening? I went to talk to some borrowers to find out. I met up with Stephen Trimble at a juice bar in downtown Philadelphia with kind of amusingly named drinks.
I get a key lime pie, and I will have a spa treatment.
Both regulars?
I was there to talk to him about the $30,000 in loans he took out to go to the University of Phoenix back in 2000 when he was 27.
You know, the University of Phoenix at that time was kind of a new phenomenon. And I'd seen, you know, television commercials and heard radio commercials, and I thought, hey, the format sounded amazing.
He went to study business management, but after 3 years, felt he wasn't really learning anything and dropped out.
When I did think about it, I felt a little bit ashamed for quitting and not seeing it through. But then I thought about the school itself and what that degree was probably going to be worth, which is bupkis, in my opinion.
Trimble has a good job as a corporate writer now and has made a pretty decent dent in his debt, getting the balance down to $17,000.
It feels like an anchor. It feels like a cloud.
At one point, his wages were garnished. His credit is pretty much destroyed.
My father helped me buy a car 3 years ago. In fact, he bought the car, and I make the payments at a 6.9% interest rate. If I had bought the car, it would be an 18.9% interest rate. I can't get a credit card without more than like a $500 limit on my own. I couldn't get a mortgage. My house is in my wife's name.
Borrowers at for-profits not only default more frequently, but they're also often from lower-income families who can't help out, or might be a little older, like Stephen, or have kids, or have a lot of other things on their plates.
The problem is that we have too many people borrowing to go to institutions and programs that we know in advance are not going to serve them well. That's a crisis.
That's Sandy Baum, who studies debt at the Urban Institute, and says a lot of these schools used aggressive marketing to draw students in.
Some of these big publicly held companies, they grew dramatically, and they signed up all kinds of people who had no idea what they were getting into.
That's now made worse because schools like ITT Tech and Corinthian have since collapsed, leaving thousands of students with ruined credit and potentially piles of debt. Jen Smith knows what that's like. She's the first person in her family to go to college. She's 31 and went to the for-profit International Academy of Design and Technology in Chicago. She left after a year and a half. IADT's parent company has since closed several campuses. When Smith went back to school to get her nursing degree, she found out the credits she earned there didn't count.
I didn't know that those credits would be worthless. I mean, I would have never. Who would sign up for something like that?
By the time she went back to get her nursing degree, her original $27,000 loan had ballooned to $45,000. Smith works in HR while studying, and she's almost relentlessly upbeat.
No one's going to drop $100,000 in my lap, nor do I expect them to. So really, all you can do is just one day at a time.
Student loan debt doesn't go away if you declare bankruptcy. Coincidentally, for Jen Smith, nursing might be a career that could make her eligible for some loan forgiveness. Some borrowers with debt from for-profits may be eligible for loan forgiveness. Almost all student debt is owned or guaranteed by the federal government. In 2010, the government took over making federal loans. They also work with servicers, companies who collect payments and process loans. Servicers will make about $2 billion in commission from the Department of Education this year. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau monitors complaints about those servicers like these: poor customer service, unexpected delays, lost paperwork, and inconsistent processing. Those come from a report by the CFPB's student loan ombudsman, Seth Frotman. I asked him why servicers who make billions from taxpayer dollars are allowed to act like this.
Congress has created a provision where every borrower has the ability to make affordable repayments. You know, we pay servicers a whole lot of money, and that is more than just to kind of take a paycheck from borrowers who are doing well. You know, we expect them, when borrowers reach out who are struggling, to ensure they know about these plans and get enrolled in these plans. You know, there are supposed to be protections for all of these borrowers who thought they were doing the right thing by going to school, taking on this historic level of debt. And the promise kind of was, you'll never really have to pay more than you can afford. And the very companies that are supposed to be ensuring that that is the case now have essentially failed these borrowers for a second time. One of the things that the Bureau has been working hard through public enforcement actions, through the first ever federal oversight of these entities, is ensuring that illegal practices will no longer be tolerated.
But I'm just not talking about illegal practices. I'm talking about all this kind of mushy stuff that gets in the way. Who is supposed to be saying to Navient or any other servicer, no, don't do that?
You know, I think the Department of Education obviously oversees the contracts with these entities. And I think one of the things you saw as part of their announcement was kind of a real concerted effort to kind of show what they expect in the future. We have said, you know,
2019?
You know, we expect servicers who have an interest with complying with the law that a lot of those provisions are expected of them now.
It seems to me that it's kind of a Wild West for servicers, that there really aren't that many rules they have to follow at all.
The challenge that we face in this space is that when a market essentially doubles over a very short time, like we saw in the student loan context, the question is, have the regulators, have the people overseeing the market, have the rules kept up? In this case, you know, they haven't. I think we've seen a lack of consistency across the marketplace. You know,
so that sounds like a yes.
Yes. And I think, you know, the only thing I would add is the Bureau has new tools at its disposal. So, you know, if we find that a company's practices are unfair, deceptive, or abusive, we have the ability to take action. But I think in terms of consistent rules that we see in credit cards or mortgages, I think this is a market that, you know, is sorely lacking those.
Marketplace and the PBS NewsHour reached out to the Department of Education about loan servicing. They declined to be interviewed. We're going to revisit some of our favorite moments from 2016 now with a special edition of the Marketplace Quiz. That's when we ask people in the spotlight about their relationship with money. We've had a lot of fun with it this year, so we're going to play a few of our favorites. Here's Marketplace producer Raghu Manavalan with our first guest.
My name is Esperanza Spalding, and I don't like to describe myself. I make sounds and art.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
I think the hardest part, what's coming to mind right now, is learning that you can't really trust the opinion of other people about the work that you're doing. You know, if your boss in the office says, like, this is not a good article, I need you to rewrite it for this reason, and then you rewrite it and you see that it's better, you go, oh, okay, I'm going to trust my boss, and also I'm accountable to him. But in music or in art, you have to find this compass in a way that's sort of insulated from other people's feedback and hold yourself accountable to the standard that you believe in. That sounds really nice, but it's actually very, 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 very challenging to keep in touch with that compass when a lot of other people are giving you opinions, good and bad, about the work that you're doing.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
Oh my God. So many things. I feel like everything that I've ever ordered on Amazon, I don't understand. I love Amazon, but I never use what I buy. It's crazy. I feel like half my bookshelf is just stuff that I one-clicked and never read and will never read. The world.
When did you realize music could be an actual paying career?
Ooh, very early, actually. Very, very early, when I was probably 15. I had a trio with a friend, with two friends, obviously. I didn't sing yet. So we built ourselves as a trio, and then we realized, wait a minute, we could charge as four people, but we're only three, because I could. What if I learned how to sing?
Yeah, true.
And that's when it all came into focus that you could do things to make more money playing music.
That's awesome.
Yeah, there were a lot of gigs at that time when I was very young in Portland, and I started gigging a lot. I never understood that you could do it for your whole life. It seemed so novel, mm-hmm. you know. I always had like 9-to-5 jobs when I was younger and older. And at one point, my boss pulled me aside and he said, you know, you can't keep missing work to do gigs. You're going to have to choose. And then I realized, like, oh, wow, I have been earning money doing gigs. Maybe I can actually pay my rent this way. And the rest is unfolding. We could change the whole story of love. Same old play, I'm getting tired of. No more acting these predictable roles. Just a sleeping, unconditional love.
What was your first job?
My first job, I worked at a place called People's Food Co-op. That was my first real job. I fell asleep as my boss was telling me things because I had just discovered that I didn't live at home anymore and I could stay out late and get in trouble and nobody would be there to notice when I came home. So I was doing that pretty much every night, and I'd go in to have meetings with my boss, Louise, and then I'd wake up to her yelling at me, saying, like, are you listening, Esperanza? And I would have fallen asleep. I was very irresponsible, and I'm really sorry, Louise, for being such a horrible employee. And I won't even tell you about working for the Portland Parks and Recreation for the No Ivy League. That was my second job.
Too cool.
I really am from Oregon. I don't know if you noticed this, but I'm from Oregon. If some
magic should find me. What is your most prized possession?
Right now, my most prized possession is the journal or the notebook in which I have been brainstorming and devising the next iteration of my project.
Mm-hmm.
If I lost that notebook, it would really hurt and sting because everything's in there. It's just real, it's raw. It's like a field journal because it's with me all the time in case mm-hmm. I think of something at the moment that seems brilliant. And if I lost that possession, it would hurt a lot. Judas, you
know the lonesome road. Last question. What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career?
Ooh, a couple things. One, no matter how daunting it seems, make sure you can repeat everything in the contract in your own language. Mm. Make sure that you can say each paragraph again in your own layman's terms. I would make sure that you can say that to a lawyer who then can tell you yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
You did understand that or you didn't understand that. I wish somebody would have said, no, you can do it by yourself first before you reach out for support or before you depend on other people for their support making your visions come to fruition. I'm learning that now, and I think I would have done some projects much better if I would have had that mode going into the creation of it. But you have a mind.
We've got another memorable quiz now. If you're a regular listener of our show, you know we love food, the money around it, the people who work with it. Here's our producer, Haley Hirschman, with someone who may have the coolest job around, because he's made food into a lifelong travel adventure.
Hi, I'm Anthony Bourdain. I have a show called Parts Unknown. I write books now and again, and I eat a lot.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
Loneliness, separation from my daughter, existential despair. I'm on the road about 250 days a year. I stay in a lot of beautiful places and look out the window at a lot of beautiful views, but I'm usually alone.
What is something that you bought that you now completely regret buying?
I mean, I've done so many stupid things in my life that buying an object, there's that Dennis Leary joke, you know, about the 70s, you know, these are your pants on drugs. I'm pretty sure I've made some bad trouser choices over time, but other than that, I ate at Johnny Rockets in an airport once, and it opened up an abyss of depression and self-loathing, a spiral of self-hatred, rage, and despair that lasted weeks. So yes, that one Johnny Rockets burger was easily the purchase that I regret more than anything in memory.
Do you remember what you had?
I ordered a cheeseburger, and it was delivered with such utter contempt and lack of care that I just, for a time, made me fear for the entire human race and the future of the planet. I mean, it doesn't take much to set me off, obviously.
Yeah. When did you realize that being a food enthusiast could be an actual career?
I guess I'd written Kitchen Confidential. I was still, I thought it would be delusional to expect that I could ever make a living writing. I mean, that's not a reasonable expectation. I was 44 years old. I was still dunking French fries for a living. But after a few months of keeping the job, because I figured this can't last, it just kept going and going. And the restaurant was filled with journalists all the time and people were offering me things. And eventually I reached this point where I thought, if I'm not really stupid and I don't screw up, I might actually be able to make a living doing this for a while. I mean, in the back of my head, I always figured I could go back to brunch. I can always cook brunch. I hate cooking brunch, but I'm good at it, and it's very difficult to find somebody who can crank out, 300 omelets and eggs bennies on a Sunday morning for a bunch of, hungover people who slept together the previous night and now hate each other and are looking for a venue where they can break up without awkwardness. But I'm your guy.
What is your most prized possession?
My most prized possession, like a physical object, is probably my knife made by Bob Kramer. He handmade me a knife, and it is the most terrifyingly expensive, beautiful object like that I own. I'm almost afraid to use it. It's so gorgeous. I mean, he makes his own steel. There's meteorite in there somewhere. It probably, you could buy a sports car for what it cost. But it is the single most beautiful physical object I own. I've had it for about a year.
So you keep it somewhere special?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're not going to say on the radio?
No. It is a knife of the gods. It's too beautiful to even look at without, just searing a hole right into your soul. I'm afraid that even talking about it, I'm making it dull somehow.
Oh, we'll move on. What was your first job?
My first job was painting a funhouse, murals in a funhouse at Palisades Amusement Park in New Jersey. I did a really bad job, but that was my first exposure. And then Bicycle Messenger in Manhattan. I did that a lot, when I was off from school.
What is something everyone should own no matter the cost?
Everyone should own a decent chef knife. It doesn't have to be a really expensive one, but a decent one. One that they keep sharp, treat with respect, and know how to use with some degree of competency. Everyone should cook. Everyone should know how to feed themselves. A few basic things. Everyone should know how to make an omelet competently for another person. Everyone should know how to roast a chicken, how to properly rest a steak. A few other basic things. Otherwise, we're lost.
What advice do you wish someone had given you before you started your career?
Well, look, all I can tell you is this. The most important lesson I ever learned in life that's carried me through everything I do, I learned as a dishwasher. It's really simple. Show up on time, always. Show people that you work with and work for the respect of doing what you said you were going to do, which is, you said you were going to show up at 9 o'clock? Show up at 9 o'clock. It says everything about you. If you do that every day, you show yourself to be the sort of person worth trusting and investing time and effort in and friendship and all those other things. If you don't show up on time, it's already a slippery slope.
Playing some of our favorite marketplace quizzes of the year, and we can't move on without a little rock and roll. So here's one more to get some music into your new year.
Hey, I'm Allison.
I'm Jamie.
We are the Kills. Okay, Jamie, I want to know. I want you to fill in the blank, okay? Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you.
Well, I mean, it can buy you a car to drive away from the misery. And can buy a house and live somewhere else away from the misery. And surround yourself with things that make you forget the misery. In the next life, what would your career be?
I would like to be a detective.
Yes, you'd be a fantastic detective.
Yeah.
She's so good. Agent Mohair, we call her.
All right, Jamie. When did you realize music could be an actual career?
people, and in some ways I'm yet to realise. Not, you know, just because I'm saying that in a way because I don't like to think of it as a career. I don't like to. I like to think of it as the thing I'm doing. And I think if you start thinking of it as a career, you start doing some pretty silly things. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess the first time was when I got the first record deal I got, and we paid. We were actually got a wage. It was in my first band, and we were earning 150 quid a week each.
What?
What is your most prized possession?
Probably my car. My Dodge Challenger with a Hemi in it is my favorite thing that I've got.
Oh.
I care for it very much and, you know, hand wax it and hand wash it and vacuum it all the time. And I talk to it and it talks to me. And no, I love my car. It's nice. It's a vehicle of freedom. It's good. Okay, Jamie, what was your first job?
My first job, I worked in a hotel, washing pots, washing up, in Hungerford. It's this little town that's famous for nothing except this guy called Michael Ryan, who went on a shooting spree and killed everybody. That's what it's famous for. I worked in a hotel there, and I had nothing to do with that. But I worked in a hotel there. I was just like, and I was like this little punk rock kid. And I was vegan, and I was really into like Flux of Indians and Crass and all that. And I sort of solved all these, you know, these older kids that work in there that I was vegan, because you sort of want to swap your kind of your cultural beliefs and things. And they locked me in the meat freezer. So I left. And that was like 4 days. Something you do. What is something everyone should own, no matter the cost?
Everyone should have a passport. I think everyone should have one of those.
I think so, too.
So you can go places, and you don't just stay home all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Learn things, see things, do things. All right, sorry, my answers are rather short. I wasn't locked in any locker.
It's all right.
Yeah, we're a good team. Okay.
You know, you're my antidote. I talk too much. You don't talk enough.
Will you call on me if I turn my back on you? Fall to the river.
What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started?
Wash your face.
Brush your teeth.
Yeah. Drink more water.
Before I started what?
So you know, started being in my band.
Oh my god.
No, I don't know. Before you started music.
Oh.
I wish they'd tell me not to be so worried. You know,
worried.
I was
about
really
what?
Worried in the early days of playing music. Just so worried about a lot of things. You know, really worried about it. Stopped me doing things sometimes because I just worried. Felt like, ooh, I can't do it. What if and all that. And I just that seems so stupid now to have been worried.
Yeah, I mean, I was rather worried when I first started playing on stage, much before I met you.
Mm.
I wouldn't look at the audience. I would stand behind things, and I couldn't.
When they rehearsed in her first band, she used to get a really long mic cable and like be in a different room to
I'd
the rest
drag
of the band.
It under the house, like in the door of the house from the garage to a bedroom, go in the bedroom and lock the door and sing from there. I couldn't even hear what they were playing, but I tried. They kicked me out of the band, obviously.
Yeah, where are they now?
Ever wonder what the Kills would look like if they were animated? Of course you have. We wondered the same thing, so we went ahead and animated some of what you just heard. You can see the results on our Facebook page. Just search for Marketplace Business News. And that's our show for this week. Next week, in keeping with the spirit of potential New Year's resolutions, we're talking with Steve Healy, CEO of Veggie Grill, a vegan fast food casual chain aiming for nationwide expansion, and Dr. author James Hamblin about his new book, If Our Bodies Could Talk. We hope you all have a happy new year. Don't forget to visit us at marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or hit us up on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills, Haley Hirschman, and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Ben Tolliday is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer, and Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.